This podcast is sponsored by Talkspace. You know when you're really stressed or not feeling so great about your life or about yourself? Talking to someone who understands can really help. But who is that person? How do you find them? Where do you even start? Talkspace. Talkspace makes it easy to get the support you need. With Talkspace, you can go online, answer a few questions about your preferences, and be matched with a therapist. And because you'll meet your therapist online, you don't have to take time off work or arrange childcare. You'll meet on your schedule, wherever you feel most at ease. If you're depressed, stressed, struggling with a relationship, or if you want some counseling for you and your partner, or just need a little extra one-on-one support, Talkspace is here for you. Plus, Talkspace works with most major insurers, and most insured members have a $0 copay. No insurance? No problem. Now, get $80 off of your first month with promo code SPACE80 when you go to Talkspace.com. Match with a licensed therapist today at Talkspace.com. Save $80 with code SPACE80 at Talkspace.com.
Help DEA keep our communities safe and healthy by participating in National Prescription Drug Take Back Day, Saturday, October 25th. Take action right in your own home by cleaning out your medicine cabinet of unneeded medications. Keep them safe, clean them out, take them back. Find a collection site near you at DEATakeBack.com. Do your part to lower overdose deaths and prevent prescription drug misuse before it starts. That's DEATakeBack.com.
Hey everyone, welcome back to the Collector's Compass, the official podcast of Collector's MD, where we explore the intersection of collecting, mental wellness, and responsible engagement in the hobby. I'm your host, Alex Efron, founder of Collector's MD, and today I'm joined by someone whose voice carries serious weight in this space. Chris McGill, better known to many of you as Chris Hodge, the co-founder of Card Ladder. Chris has been at the forefront of building transparency, structure, and trust in the hobby, and he's consistently advocated for a healthier and more sustainable future. Chris, thank you for being here.
It is my pleasure to be here, Alex. Thank you very much for having me.
Of course. Before we get into some of the heavy stuff that we're going to talk about today, how are things on your end? How's life in the Midwest been treating you? How is the rest of your summer?
I have no complaints. It actually got unseasonably cold during August where I'm at. And so we got an early fall, but NFL's back on, NBA's coming back soon. Those are my two favorite sports. And I don't know, man, the time just flies. Like I just felt like we were at National yesterday and it's already a month and a half ago.
Isn't that crazy? It's already fall. I mean, I'm kind of jealous that you're getting some of the cooler weather. It's still pretty warm here. I was in Spain for a couple of weeks with my wife and the in-laws towards the end of August into early September, and it was hot. It was like, yeah, unbearable. And what's crazy is the week before we were there, it was like 115 degrees. So quite literally wouldn't have been able to walk outside had we gone 1 week earlier. But it's good to be back. It's good to be in the thick of things, especially with football season upon us. Week two starts tonight between the Green Bay Packers and Washington Commanders. I know we have a lot of football fans amongst us, so that should be very exciting. Love it. So let's start at the beginning, because your path back into the hobby has a lot of overlap with what so many of us have experienced. So the first segment here, we're calling Chris's Path into the Hobby. And so one of the things I love about your story, and for those of you who are watching, Chris and I were both on a podcast with Jeremy Lee a couple months ago. We have since had the opportunity to connect one-on-one, and we had some really candid conversations about the current state of the hobby, amongst other things. So I have a little bit of a context of Chris's background and what he's into. So one of the things, Chris, that I love about your story is how it blends nostalgia with research. And you've said before that the MJ Ultra Scoring Kings card was your holy grail as a kid. And that coming back in 2016 was almost like reconnecting with an old friend, right? So that's something a lot of listeners, I think, can relate to, coming back to the hobby during different life stages, maybe as an adult and realizing it hits differently later in life. So could you take us back? Like, what was the first spark for you as a kid?
Yeah, you know, here's why I want to start with this, and this is going to be a lightning rod, but whatever. One of my earliest experiences with cards was the repack, but not the way that it's done today, not with the circus atmosphere that we often find accompanying that, but instead through the good old-fashioned garage sale repack, which is where people who were collecting cards, and you know, I was born in 86, so this was, you know, when I was young, like early 90s, and my mom would love to go garage sailing around the neighborhood, and I would come with, and people would sell these little team bags that would have 25 or 50 commons from like NBA Hoops or the base set of Upper Deck. They would just sort of repackage them into these little team bags, and you know, they would be 25 cents or 10 cents or something like that. And I think that was some of my earliest exposure to cards, was these little repurposed team bags of cards that people had pulled from boxes. And, you know, I wasn't buying fresh packs or boxes quite yet. I was just sort of, you know, what are these? These are cool. I love sports. You know, I grew up in the greater Chicago area. So that the 90s were a great, great time to be a basketball fan. And so that was kind of my start, was these these commons, and I just loved organizing them, you know, putting them in the correct order according to their card numbers, filling binder sheets with them, trying to complete sets, and reading the statistics on the back. I've always enjoyed numbers and statistics. And so it was just this amazing collecting cards, even at that level, was just it was so much fun, you know, because I've always also had a real enjoyment of recording things, of documenting things. And so what I would end up doing is, because you know, we would play like basketball in the neighborhood, on the basketball hoops in our front yards or on our driveways, and I made my own trading card sets using like those gold and silver pens that we use, like metallic or like paint pens that we used to have in the 90s. And I would take these little note cards and I would make cards of all of us. I would make a card for myself. I would make a card for my brother, make a card for the neighbors that we were playing basketball with. You know, if any adults joined us, I'd make cards for them, put them in the set. And then I would draw my own like Beckett magazines, and I would sort of like price all the different cards, and then like price up, price down. And I would just invent statistics for whole seasons and stuff. So like cards were this canvas that this blank canvas that allowed me to fill it in and paint it with all my imaginative and creative outlets as a kid. And that's really where it started. But then the card that you mentioned, the Scoring Kings, that was transformative. That was truly transformative for me, because the card was so different than the other things that I'd seen. It was so beautiful. It had the full surface was this shiny foil, and it was this concept. You know, it was the concept of Jordan set against this lightning strike in the background, and this idea that there's just this little 9 or 10 player set of all the quote unquote scoring kings, and Jordan was obviously my favorite player. But when he retired, then I shifted over to Hakeem Olajuwon being my favorite player. So those were my two icons of the 90s, were those two guys. But yeah, the advent of the holofoil or the foil background on cards was a big moment for me. That sort of, you know, and it's like the Jordan scoring kings, I never got one as a kid. It was too expensive, but there was a card shop that was in a strip mall that was maybe about a mile from my house, and my buddies and I would ride our bikes up there from time to time. And the Jordan Scoring Kings was always there was always a copy of it sitting in the display case at that card shop, and it was, you know, $150 or $200, and like, I know, how am I going to get $150? So I would just gaze at it and I would envy it. And so, yeah, when I came back to the hobby in 2016, when I was about 29 or 30, you know, at that time, that this was the card I wanted immediately. I could never afford it as a kid. I want to come back and buy a copy now. And so I did.
Awesome. And this is the card, right, that I have up on the screen?
That is the one right there.
And so did they have parallels of this card, or was this just like the only one?
That's it. There were two beautiful foil inserts from 1993-94 Ultra. There were like all foil. There were more inserts too. There was like the Inside Out insert and several other inserts. But the two like flashy foil inserts were this one, the Scoring Kings, which came from Series 1, I think. And then I think Ultra Series 2 had the Power and the Key, which was a very beautiful card as well. And that actually was like the biggest card that I had as a kid was I got a Chris Webber Power and the Key. And 93-94 was his rookie season. So that was like a really cool rookie card of his. And that was like when I went back and found my old collection, that was the card that earned the place in my one screw down holder, like my fanciest holder. It was that Chris Webber card in it.
I'm going to see if I could pull that one up real quick. Present screen share. And here it is. It's this one, right? Oh, let me add it to the stage.
There it is. Yep. That's it. It still gives me, a real, a sense of nostalgia looking at it. Same for the Scoring Kings too.
Yeah, I think a lot of us have experienced that in many different ways with similar sets across different sports. It's really a beautiful thing when you can look at a card and it can just bring you back to a moment in time that is one that you remember, cherish, and it's like music, right? You hear a song, or maybe like you smell something, you walk into like your, I don't know, grandmother's home and you smell her cooking, or, you know, the mothballs in the basement, and it just brings you right back. Right. I think cards can do that the same way a lot of other things in life can. And that's one of the beautiful things about collecting and sports cards and the hobby. Awesome, man. When you stepped away, what pulled you back in 2016?
Well, the thing that pulled me away initially was I really stopped collecting cards around eighth grade, freshman year in high school. And I just put them away. I just put them into boxes and buried them at the bottom of my closet. And that's because I was becoming obsessed with music production, which would become my first career. So around that time, this was around the time that Napster was launching and becoming a big thing, and like software-based music production was on the rise, and I was sort of like part of that wave of people who were creating music and uploading it, and I would go on to work in the music industry as my first like job, and as a music producer. So like that really took me away from cards. But I came back. I worked as a music producer. I did that for like 7-ish years. And then I went back to school. And so I started a community college, and I transferred to a 4-year university. And then I took a year off to study for the LSAT. And then I went to law school. And so during that gap year, when I was studying for the LSAT, I had just graduated from a 4-year university. But I was a non-traditional age. I was like at the end of my 20s. After I graduated, I knew I had law school on the horizon. I had this year when I'm supposed to be studying for the LSAT so I can get into a good law school. But I got so distracted. It's like right after I graduated college, like I just needed a mental break, I think, or something. And I came back home to my parents' house to spend my gap year there. And I discovered my old collection. All of a sudden, like I was obsessed. Like I discovered these old cards, and I was like, I wonder if these are worth anything. And I go online and I start looking it up, and I'm like, oh my gosh, there's this whole hobby has completely changed from what I remember what it was like. And so I ordered the Beckett annual almanac from the most recent year, and I started diving down the eBay research rabbit hole and just started organizing all my old cards and then selling off some of them so I could get a couple of bucks in to buy some new cards, and bought the Scoring Kings, and just I was off and running from there. And awesome. The thing that brought me back, I think it was partially the age. You know, I think that a lot of us return in our late 20s or early 30s or later. But I think a lot of us sort of return when we are in an adulthood and we're confronted with the complexities of everyday life and the challenges of everyday life and the stresses of providing for ourselves, providing for our families. And I think that cards are just this great, simple, nostalgic release that provides a connection back to childhood. And the connection to childhood is so powerful because the simplicity of childhood is one of its greatest aspects, that as kids, that we're free of these adult burdens, and that we just, our imaginations run wild, and we're, we, and we just, we, we, we're, creative and feel, you know, a bit lighter and stuff. And so the hobby and card collecting, providing an avenue to channel back to a simpler childhood experience and time, I think that was a really big part of sort of why I enjoyed it as an escape.
Yeah, it's a great point. I think nostalgia just ties us back in. It brings us together too, right? Because so many of us have similar stories in terms of, you know, the time we grew up and what we enjoyed as kids. I grew up in the 90s. I was born in 1989, so we're not too far apart in age. And I think, you know, there was probably a lot of synergies there just in terms of things that we both enjoyed, appreciated, collected. And so when I got back into the hobby in 2020, it was very similar for me. There were so many things that, you know, I didn't realize were still so popular from when I was a kid. And it's, you know, in a lot of ways, just a really beautiful thing to see. And so when you returned in 2016, you mentioned obviously the hobby landscape was a lot different than, you know, what it looked like when you left it, for both good and bad. Obviously, in 2016, the hobby looked a lot different than it does today. But I'm curious, what did it look like in 2016 compared to when you left it?
The internet is the big thing. This is the first one of the first times like I'm really confronting.
This podcast is sponsored by Talkspace. You know, when you're really stressed or not feeling so great about your life or about yourself, talking to someone who understands can really help. But who is that person? How do you find them? Where do you even start? Talkspace. Talkspace makes it easy to get the support you need. With Talkspace, you can go online, answer a few questions about your preferences, and be matched with a therapist. And because you'll meet your therapist online, you don't have to take time off work or arrange childcare. You'll meet on your schedule, wherever you feel most at ease. If you're depressed, stressed, struggling with a relationship, or if you want some counseling for you and your partner, or just need a little extra one-on-one support, Talkspace is here for you. Plus, Talkspace works with most major insurers, and most insured members have a $0 copay. No insurance? No problem. Now, get $80 off of your first month with promo code SPACE80 when you go to Talkspace.com. Match with a licensed therapist today at Talkspace.com. Save $80 with code SPACE80 at Talkspace.com.
How old that makes me sound. But the internet, you know, like when we were collecting in the 90s, we had Beckett monthly magazines and we had regional card shows and card shops. And, you know, that was it. I mean, I was lucky if I could get to go to a regional card show or two, you know, or get a trip to the local card shop and have a couple bucks to spend up there, or, you know, going garage sailing and picking up those 25-cent team baggies. But, yeah, you know, this isn't true of only the hobby, but culture in general. The 90s were sort of the last decade of mass culture and media and content that spoke with a relatively monolithic voice. And the hobby, I think, was very lucky to have Beckett magazines, because Beckett magazines were extremely professional, top notch. The editorial work was excellent. The methodologies and the approach to functioning as a price guide was exemplary. It made the hobby very feel very serious and also fun. But I could walk to the local grocery store and look at the magazine section back when there used to be a big magazine stand, and there would be the Sports Illustrated magazine right there, and it would look beautiful. And there would be other publications right there, and they'd look great. And the Beckett magazine would be right there, the monthly Beckett magazine for all the different sports. And it just fit in, you know. It really made sports card collecting feel like a part of something bigger and a part of the presentation of these sports at the professional level. And so, you know, that was the experience as a kid, is like having binders, getting my content through those monthly magazines. And then, you know, going to the local card shop, or maybe like a couple kids in the neighborhood had a few cards, but they weren't into it like I was. My brother had cards as well, so like he and I would sort of, you know, like trade or compare collections and stuff. But that was it as a kid. And then come back in 2016, and the internet is just changing everything. It's like at that time, social media was starting to become a hub for collectors. But collectors, I think, were still quite concentrated on message boards, and sort of message boards were the medium of the early to mid 2000s. And so, you know, you could see how sports car collecting had migrated to there during that time. And I wasn't collecting at that time, but I could see the remnants in the history in the archives of these message forums in the mid 2010s when I came back. And so I took to the message forums. I learned a ton. I read so much. I met amazing people there. But there was a migration happening to social media. And so, you know, Instagram, like I started my card collecting Instagram in 2016, just posting like cards from my childhood and meeting people that way. And like Facebook groups were starting to take off, but they were still modest. But the communities were forming, you know, the communities were starting to build. And so the internet was providing this community building, these various community building platforms that just didn't exist in the 90s. And then of course, eBay. You know, the ability to access this global marketplace with a very trusted brand. And eBay was something that I had used to buy and sell things non-card related prior to returning to the hobby. So I immediately felt comfortable that I could sell my cards, like some of my old collection, to raise some funds to buy some new cards. I could do that. I could sell these cards on eBay if I wanted to. I could feel comfortable and trust the buying experience on eBay. So all of a sudden now I can be a fully operating collector just from my phone. And that was just amazing. I couldn't believe that. And so, you know, the combination of the communities that the internet provided and the marketplace and the transactional opportunities that the internet provided, you know, so like I can build a collection, I can start gaining cards and I can show them off. I can share them with other collectors. I can learn from other collectors. Those were the huge differences.
Yeah. You know, one thing that I feel like doesn't get talked about enough is how technology has actually helped the hobby evolve in a lot of positive ways. You know, we talk quite a bit at Collectors MD about how technology has sort of hindered the hobby, but you know, I think it's actually helped the hobby evolve quite a bit. Like, for example, you know, you think back 15 or 20 years ago, if you wanted to track prices, like you're talking about, like you basically had to buy a Beckett magazine or, you know, scroll through whatever version of eBay existed back then, maybe sold listings, and hope you weren't getting taken advantage of. Now, you know, we have tools like Card Ladder, of course, which we'll get into in a bit, or even just eBay's own filters. We have real-time data. Collectors can make smarter, more intentional choices instead of going into it blind. I think it's also made the hobby a lot more accessible. Things like live streams and social platforms give people from all over the world a way to connect. And you don't need to live near a card shop to make it to the national or to a card show to be part of the community. You can be there sort of virtually or digitally, which I think is really cool. And technology has essentially turned collecting into a global conversation. People sharing pickups on Instagram, running live trades on Discord or Reddit, or even just connecting through YouTube comments or in Facebook groups. I think that sense of connection can be really powerful, especially for people who might otherwise feel like they're collecting by themselves or in isolation, especially as adults. And then, of course, there's the organization side, the apps for cataloging your PC, the scanners that can digitize your collection in minutes, grading submissions that you can track online, things of that nature. I think for people who naturally are prone to chaos, let's call it, and let's face it, many of us are when it comes to stacks of cards, right? These tools give us structure and peace of mind. So while there are definitely challenges, I think that come with the tech-driven side of the hobby, like, excuse me, like over-commercialization or the casino culture that we talk about of breaks, I think it's important to also acknowledge the flip side, and that technology has given us education, community, and tools for discipline that simply just didn't exist when we were kids. So I appreciate you bringing that up. So from there, you know, it wasn't just about collecting. You turned your passion into content and then into a business. Let's talk a little bit about that. So we're going to get into our next segment where we're going to talk a little bit about House of Jordans as well as Card Ladder. Excuse me, I've had a tickle in my throat the last couple of days, which has been driving me nuts. Okay, so I want to talk a little bit about your YouTube channel. So correct me if I'm wrong, you had a YouTube channel that debuted back in 2018 called House of Jordans.
Yeah, I think the YouTube might have debuted a little later, maybe in 2019, but we had a podcast that debuted in 2018. Yeah, called The House of Jordans. Yep, we sure did. And I think you're very similar in this way too. The enjoyments of the community, the enjoyments of collecting, but also the desire to express a point of view can really snowball as you start to get deeper into the hobby, enjoy the hobby more, participate in it more, learn more about it. And, you know, content creation, it's a very low barrier to entry, you know, just, it's really just as simple as like pointing a device at yourself or, you know, getting a microphone and recording some stuff.
Sure.
And, or just going on Instagram Live and sharing some thoughts, or, you know, even when we post our cards, when we share our cards, we are creating content. It's not the traditional notion of like a video or a podcast or something long form, but it's content. And people enjoy it and they consume it. And so I was just having a great time, but I also had things I wanted to say, observations I wanted to make. And, you know, so I just, it naturally took the next step into content creation, and I had a background in it, right? I worked in the music business. I knew how to produce audio. And so, you know, I had microphones, et cetera. So it was pretty seamless for me to just immediately start making this podcast. And so, yeah, we started the House of Jordans podcast, and then that plugged me into the very small network of content creators at that time. And there were several, but there weren't many. And so some of the ones that were live at that time were the Wax Museum podcast hosted by Kyle, which is a great podcast. Also 90s B-ball cards on YouTube hosted by Jake. You know, he is one of the most original and dedicated and passionate content creators around, especially around 90s basketball products. And then, of course, the person who would go on to be one of my business partners and co-founders and great, great friends, which is Josh Johnson of Cardboard Chronicles. And his YouTube channel, Cardboard Chronicles and podcast, it was completely oriented around the interview. And the way that he approached it was just brilliant, because what he would do is he would build relationships and contacts with the greatest collectors and up-and-coming business leaders in the space. And then he would just interview them. And his interview style was so calm and so open. You know, just he would just ask some open-ended questions and let collectors tell their stories in a way that nobody was doing at that time. And so he really opened up this floodgate of content surrounding collectors telling their stories in a long-form medium. And I just loved what he was doing. And so he and I connected and we collaborated on some content. Yep, there's Josh. And we collaborated on some content. And then, you know, as we kept talking, he and I are both entrepreneurial and we're both passionate and we're both hardworking people. And so, you know, we always would be, you know, sharing potential business ideas with each other, basically. Like, how can we build something here? How can we do more? And the timing just so happened to work out that we had been talking about for a long time, sort of devising some sort of product that would help people track prices to sort of become a 21st century price guide. And, you know, but he had a full-time job. I was a full-time law student and I was working while I was in law school. So it was tough. Like, it was really tough. But then in the 2020s, which was my final semester of law school, was the spring of 2020, COVID-19 happened and stay-at-home orders happened. And all my classes in law school, the final 2 months of them, were done from home, and all the classes went pass fail. And the bar exam for new graduates kept getting pushed back. And, you know, all of a sudden it was like, wow, we have time and we're stuck at home. And, you know, what if we built something? So like, we'd been talking about it, we'd been building and developing this idea, it was organically arising, and then just the societal context allowed for it to immediately accelerate and just be like, okay, let's shoot our shot. And Josh had a lot of great experience on the software and tech side, and so he was really like push, and it was very smart that he did it this way. He was like, look, let's just build something, even if it's a skeleton of something. It's called an MVP, a minimum viable product.
Right.
We'll put it out. And then, yeah, it's not going to be a perfect product, but we're going to get feedback from people. People are going to tell us how to improve it. We will improve it. We'll iterate as we go. We'll continue to make it better and we'll build. And so that's what we did. And so we had the soft launch of Card Ladder, which was by invite only for the first month and a half or so. That was on June 23rd of 2020. And that day was really significant, that being 6/23, 6 for June and the 23rd day, because Josh's main collection is LeBron. LeBron wears a jersey number 6. And 6 is also Josh's favorite number. And in 23, you know, I collect Michael Jordan. Christina collects Michael Jordan. And so in 23, obviously, is Michael Jordan's primary jersey number. So we picked that day. It was symbolic for us. We launched Card Ladder. And it was very humble at the start. It was a very modest product, but we built and grew it.
What year was that again?
2020.
It feels like, I mean, I've been in the hobby a little bit before then, but it feels like Card Ladder has been a part of the hobby now for as long as I can remember. I feel like it was already a mainstay when I got back into it, even though you had founded it after the fact. So I think that just goes to show the, you know, just the power it holds in the space. And you guys really have become leaders in the industry. And so, you know, Card Ladder was built, you guys have built a reputation on transparency and trust. What were the guiding principles you set from day one?
Yeah, so, and this is something that that I really took from law school. I've always had an interest, like my undergraduate degree was in ethics, politics, and economics. And I've always been interested in the intersection of those three things. And law is definitely the intersection of those things and others. But as a law student, and especially, you know, law is professional school. Law is training people to become attorneys. The field of law has serious ethical and licensing requirements. And you can easily get disbarred for unethical behavior, either in the professional setting or in your personal life too. And so one of the focal points of a legal education, especially at the vocational level, is to train up and coming students in law to be ethical practicing attorneys who are compliant with and upholding the standards of the profession. And so one of the things that just really stuck with me from law school, one of the very best professors I had in law school was actually somebody who was a managing partner at a firm who just happened to teach a course just because he loved law. And the thing that he taught me and my classmates was the importance of credibility in front of a judge. And here's what that means. And here's why that's so important. In a lawyer's practice, much of their work is going to revolve, especially on the litigation side, which is what I was interested in. A lot of a lawyer's work is going to revolve around standing up in a court of law and explaining things to a judge. And that's going to involve telling the facts of your case or the facts that pertain to your client. That's going to involve citing case law. And that's going to involve making legal arguments, pushing for the establishment of new precedents, you have to make lots of arguments and the key here is that an attorney will know more about those particular cases, and they'll know more about a particular area of legal scholarship, and they'll know more about the facts of the case that they're presenting than the judge will. The judge has a full docket. They can't have the depth of knowledge of this particular case that the attorney working on it has. So there is an expectation that the judge can trust the attorneys. The judge has to be able to trust the attorneys who are presenting in their court of law, that the attorneys are going to fairly present case law and facts, and that if the attorney is on the losing side of an argument, or if the attorney doesn't have the precedent that they need to advance the point that they would like, that the attorney will be honest and upfront about that and not try to sneak one by the goalie. Because if the attorney does try to trick the judge or to mislead the judge or to hide facts or to hide case law that hurts them, they might be able to get one over on the judge at first, but here's what's going to happen. The judge is going to eventually find out that they did that. And now the judge won't trust anything that attorney says anymore. Now the judge is going to have to take every comment from that attorney, and they're going to have their clerks fact check it, and they're going to be skeptical of it. And the credibility that whatever credibility that attorney had, it's gone. And once the credibility is gone, now that attorney's life is very difficult. It's hard to stand up in front of a judge and be able to say anything. And the relationship is crumbled. And then judges are not isolated. Judges talk to other judges. And so all of a sudden, an attorney can build a reputation very quickly that they're not credible, that they distort things, that they lie, that they exaggerate. And that can be very detrimental to their ability to practice law. So that lesson always resonated with me, the importance of credibility and honesty. And, you know, if something isn't in my favor, just be upfront about it and be transparent about it. And yeah, maybe, you know, that means you end up losing a point on this case or something, but guess what? You lost. There's, you know, that the facts or the case wasn't on your side, but what you gain is the respect and the credibility of the legal community. And that is a very valuable piece of an attorney's offering as a professional. I transposed that idea onto the hobby, onto the industry, onto building a product in this space, with the idea being that we are working in the realm of pricing. And in pricing, there are problems. There are shilled auctions. There are paid auctions that are manipulated for the purpose of printing a comp that can help somebody dump a card on an unsuspecting person who isn't aware of it. And so among all these shenanigans that happen within the market for sports cards, that if we're going to be tasked with tracking these things, that we should do everything we can to help contextualize those facts. We should put the facts as transparently as possible in front of people, and that we should make as our goal and our aim to be as credible and as transparent and as honest and forthright as possible on all levels. And so that was the founding principle for offering this product. And it obviously is important with tracking pricing data, but it's important in the offering of any product in this space, especially because this space is just very, you know, entrepreneurial. It's fly by the seat of your pants. There's very little institutionalization. There's no professional school that trains us. Like, law has professional school. It has the bar. It has all these societies and standards and ethics and professional responsibility courses and so on and so forth that enforce the standards of that industry. We don't have any of that in cards. We have just the credibility and the integrity of the people, and then the clients have the ability to speak with their dollars, and to, if they don't like a product, they can go somewhere else or cancel or not shop there. But you know, so within this space, within the hobby space, being the initiator of bringing integrity and credibility to the table, I always felt like not only was that something that I learned from law school, something I believed in before law, and something that should govern the operation of a business, but also that it would also be advantageous, because the people of the hobby are smart people. They're credible people. The people of the hobby often work in other industries. Maybe they're doctors, maybe they're teachers, you know, or dentists or whatever they are. You know, they will appreciate that there are people taking the standards of other industries and trying to and self-enforcing them in the launch of a product in the sports card collecting space. So that's how the guiding principles and the ethics of law that I learned as a law student, that those really helped us build and design a product with those as bedrock principles. And I think that ultimately, I think that gave us a nice position in the market as well, that people could look and say, these people are trying their best to run their business honestly and with integrity.
Yeah, that's a really interesting point, because we've had conversations with therapists and doctors on this show and, you know, through the Collectors MD movement, where we apply a lot of the principles and, you know, maybe different types of therapy. There's like this CAGE questionnaire that is used for alcoholics that we have adapted to compulsive collecting, things like that. And so to do the same sort of thing in the world of law, or in the field of law, I think is really, really intriguing. And so I really like the point you made about, you know, staying true to your values and your principles. I think in life and in the hobby, your values are your compass, right? And if you abandon them for a quick win, whether that's chasing hype, cutting corners, or getting caught up in comps, you might feel like you're winning in that moment, but over time, that win will cost you more than it gives back. So when you stick to your principles, collecting with intention, staying within your filters, protecting your peace, all of these different values that we talk about within Collectors MD, you might miss out on a deal or a hit today, but in the long run, you build a collection, a reputation, and a sense of self that lasts forever. And so we always say short-term hype fades, long-term integrity pays. So that's a good point. I love it. So this is a good segue, you know, speaking of guiding principles, I think that ties right into something central for both of us, and that's how we handle the ethical side of the hobby. So we're going to get into our next segment, which is guardrails, responsible messaging, and shared values. So at Collectors MD, our mission has always been simple, but it's non-negotiable. That's support, accountability, and change, which is what you see up on the screen. We believe in creating guardrails in the hobby, tools, education, and community that keep collectors safe from the same compulsive cycles I myself fell into. We don't believe in canceling, you know, break culture or shaming people who spend big. We believe in creating a healthier ecosystem where collectors can enjoy the hobby without losing themselves while doing it. And we emphasized collecting with intention and not compulsion. So Chris, I see Card Ladder as having a parallel mission. Your team has fought to keep data transparent, to build trust, and to protect collectors from hype-driven manipulation. And that's where I think our values intersect, right? So let me give you the floor. How do you see the role of Card Ladder in creating those guardrails for the community?
Well, I love the way that you put that. I also love how you connected different professional categories such as, you know, therapy and others, which can give us tools and insights to become better and happier collectors. I think you know, my slogan or my approach to the hobby has always been a very simple one, which is that the reason why I collect cards, the reason why I work in the space, the reason why I love it is because it makes my life better. I can feel that. I could measure that. My life before returning to collecting cards involved a lot of doom scrolling, a lot of headline reading, you know, just a lot of negativity, a lot of sort of aimless behavior, and not, you know, I'm not condemning anybody who does that. I obviously did that too, but I was, you know, I there was a little bit of purpose missing. And then when I found collecting cards, all of a sudden this recreational outlet really started giving me a lot of purpose. And the more I dug in, the more I enjoyed it. It enhanced my sports fandom tremendously. I've taken such an interest in statistical approaches to measuring sports performance, and it's become this great snowball. The compounding effect of enjoying the hobby and enjoying sports, and the reinforcing cycle there has been awesome. So that's always been sort of my approach to the hobby, is that it's made my life better. And, you know, to the point of guardrails, which I think is an excellent point that you've raised, is that, you know, how can we in each of our humble ways contribute to making the hobby a better experience for every person? So that, so just as I'm able to have a better time in the hobby, how could I possibly step up and make it better for somebody else too? And right. So I think there's a number of ways to do that. I think content creation is a way to do that. And that's separate from the Card Ladder product. It's just collectors turning on a microphone and talking about their collecting experience, or writing a post for social media, or just hanging out together and sharing collecting stories. The sense of community and encouraging each other and focusing on the things that are ethical and that make us happy as collectors. I think that's a very rewarding and proactive way that almost anybody can step up and contribute. And I encourage as many people who want to make content, I encourage them to do it. I consume a ton of hobby content. I'm always listening to a podcast or a YouTube stream, and I just love it. I wish there was even more. And so I think content creation is a way to share collecting practices, beliefs, and philosophies. And then within the Card Ladder product itself, the goal here, the aim, is that we're providing people information that it can be a tool to help them responsibly, carefully, and methodically craft collections. And so using for example, sales histories and pricing histories, you know, people can really be taken advantage of if they don't have an understanding of price histories and comp histories for cards. And so, you know, people at shows, for example, they can, a dealer might have a card highly marked up. And if the collector who walks up to the table doesn't understand what the price history looks like for this card, they might end up paying a ton of money for that card. And look, for people who are happy doing that, that's fine. But for people who, you know, would like the ability to very quickly reference, you know, either by taking a picture of the card or just typing a few words from the card's title into the sales history and just sort of figure out, get a sense of what the market value is for this card, I think that's helpful. I think that helps people responsibly build collections so that they don't end up overpaying for something way above market, or that if they do overpay for it, that they understand what the market bears, and that if they were to turn around and try to sell that exact same card right after they purchased it, that they're probably not going to get the value back from it. So I think that there's a real value in providing people information just as a whole. And then the Card Ladder product itself is just geared around supporting the enterprise of collecting, whether it's, you know, having a feature that lets you upload pictures of all of your cards and sort of manage your collection. You can turn on the value tracking aspect of that if you'd like to. You can see all the other different collections that members have elected to make public if they opt in to sharing their collections on the showcase feature. And then there's just, you know, broader market information so that collectors can get a sense of the directionality and get a sense of pricing trends. Like, they can look at the Card Ladder 50 index and sort of say, you know, is the market really hot right now? How much price wise using that's a price weighted index based on 50 component cards. Are prices hot right now? You know, the Card Ladder 50 index is up like 17% in the last quarter. You know, people can look at that and decide, you know, what do they want to do with that information? Does that information counsel caution? And to me, it does, but you know, to others, maybe not. I try to always avoid telling somebody what they should or they shouldn't buy, but instead just provide people information and be honest and transparent about what I'm doing, you know, and let people know here are the cards. Like, my, for example, my full collection can be viewed through the showcase feature on Card Ladder. So people can see all the different cards they've got. They can see all the different players I collect. And that's important, I think, for me to do as a head researcher and as a co-founder and an operator of the Card Ladder business. People should see who I collect. People should know where biases might lie with me, players I might be biased in favor of. I try to control for that, obviously, but it's there. These are the players that I like. These are the players that I collect. People can know that, you know, people can make informed decisions based on that. So, you know, I think that's in a nutshell, you know, those are things that I think are very valuable to this hobby in terms of being able to contribute to its moral compass, is that content creation and then through the Card Ladder medium of providing people with information.
Awesome. And just to give people an idea of what that showcase looks like. And of course, we have some incredible Mahomes pieces here. This is one of the features on Card Ladder, which I find really, really awesome. I think it's really cool that you can sort of put your collection into a digital showcase like this and share it with whoever you want. You don't need to have it on you at all times. It's kind of works as a portfolio of sorts. You can clearly sort of filter it based on specific players you collect. And I just think this is really sharp and really like what you guys are doing there. Awesome. So why do words like investment versus speculation matter in shaping collector behavior?
Love this question. Love this topic. So this is, let me preface my response here by saying that that I don't intend to finger wag or lecture anybody who is using terms like investment, and I can understand where they're coming from, but I do have concerns around it, and here are some of them. So there's a non-technical use of the word investment, and we'll see this used in ordinary everyday life, like I'm investing in my health by going to a gym, or I'm investing into my children's future by preparing them for life with you know, discipline and good habits, or making sure they do their homework or whatever. And in these ways, you know, we use the word investment, and it doesn't really mean a financial return necessarily. It just means that I'm investing time or resources or in some cases money into something that I'm hoping pays off in some way, maybe by becoming healthier, or maybe by my kids having a successful life and flourishing and having good habits and skills and stuff. So, you know, that's the colloquial way of using the term investment. And it can, you know, I've invested time into something. I invested 3 hours into watching the Chicago Bears lose on Monday night, you know. So we use it colloquially. But then there's also a very technical use of the term investment, which exists in inside markets and inside the space of finance. And that, generally speaking, investment refers to a revenue-generating asset. And so that could refer to a stock that pays a dividend. That could refer to a bond that pays interest. That could refer to a piece of real estate that has the ability to generate rental value. Or that could refer to owning a share of a business that pays you a profit or some form of revenue generation on that level. Those are revenue generating assets. That's the more technical idea of what an investment is. And then enter the idea of a sports card. How does that fit into this scheme? And so a sports card, you know, is it a consumer good? It is, but you don't ever fully consume it, right? Like the sports cards can deliver you utility day after day, and they can actually appreciate in price. They can actually gain value. So it's not really the standard idea of a consumer good, although it does fit under that category pretty well. Is it investment? Well, cards do, like I said, appreciate in price, but they're not revenue generating. They're not like a piece of real estate or a dividend paying stock or owning a share of a business. Cards do generate utility. They can definitely make people happy and bring a sense of happiness, but they don't have any inherent revenue generating properties. Now, somebody could push back there and say, well, maybe you could loan your card to a museum or something. And like there is technically that is right, but by and large, the normal use case for a sports card doesn't involve it operating as a revenue generating asset. So it's not really quite an investment in the technical sense. Sure, in the colloquial sense, it can be, hey, I invested $100 into this card. I'd like to get $150 back out of it. Like that's a very everyday common usage of the term. But when we're talking in the context of markets, and in the context of something that's adjacent to finance, that the professionals in those spaces will step in and they'll say, I don't think we should necessarily be calling sports cards investments. That's a technical term that means something a little bit different. Instead, these are speculations and these are collectibles. And that's the category that they live under. They are collectible items. They have the potential to appreciate, but their market and their price, it's driven by nostalgia. It's driven by demand. It's driven by hype. And so because that is the nature of these sports cards and of these items as collectibles, it's more technically accurate to call them speculative or things or collectibles that we're speculating on. And that doesn't mean that they can't have a robust market or that they can't appreciate in price, but it keeps the distinction clean between a traditional idea, a technical idea of what an investment is versus what a speculation is. And then here's why that's important. So another quick law school anecdote here. I took the course Corporations, or also known as Business Law, from a really smart professor. And during that semester, he dedicated a significant portion of one of his lectures to the greater fool theory. And he gave us this big pitch on how stocks that don't pay dividends are hot potatoes. That was his academic rigorous point of view, is that owning a stock that doesn't pay a dividend he pretty much felt it was a scam. Okay, so that's very strong. All right, that's a very, very strong take that he's coming with there. But the point is that he was being very technical about it. He was saying that a stock that doesn't pay a dividend and that doesn't give you any control in the operation of the company, that's really something that's mostly just being speculated on. That's the idea that, you know, somebody's just going to pay you more for it later. And that is very much transposable onto how some people approach sports cards. So the idea here that professor was trying to convey in his lecture, and that is applicable to the context of sports card collecting as a whole, is that using the word investment can create or blur, it could create a false impression, or it can blur the boundary between traditional assets that generate revenue and a sports card whose value is derived from entertainment, utility, and speculation. And if those boundaries start getting too blurred, there is a concern that people, especially people who are new, can start to think, well, a sports card is interchangeable with my 401k, or a sports card is interchangeable with a bond that pays interest. Like these are all just investments. And so, you know, it can lead potentially to people making some financially irresponsible choices or choices that aren't fully informed, because there's this notion, this idea that a sports card is a revenue generating asset, but it's not upon an inspection. It's something slightly different. So that's the concern, is that the word investment can start to blur the boundary between things that there actually is a firm boundary in between.
100%. Yeah, I think that's a really great point. A lot of folks try to justify their sports cards collections, not just their sports cards collections, but any sort of tangible asset, any collectible item, as a real investment, something similar to a 401k or a mutual fund or something like that. And that's just, yeah, to your point, it's irresponsible. It's not necessarily realistic. You know, and not to go off on a tangent, but, you know, bringing up that subject, you have folks like Kevin O'Leary coming into the picture, who are calling the sports card hobby, you know, a terrific alternative asset. There's certain finance jargon that he uses to really spruce it up and make it sound fancy. But, you know, we just have to be really, really careful. You know, he's obviously playing in a completely different lane, and the types of cards that he's investing in, upwards of, you know, eight figures at times, it's just not something that I think we can compare, you know, to us regular collectors. Awesome. So I have two more questions on this segment. I know you have a hard stop at 4 o'clock. Are we able to go over a few minutes?
Unfortunately, I do need to eject when we get to four.
Okay. Then we'll probably have to table a few of these other segments that we had planned. I'll ask you these two questions. You can answer quickly, and then we'll kind of fast forward to the end here. Maybe we'll schedule a part two where we can touch on these other subjects, because there's some really interesting stuff here that I think will bring a lot of value to our audience. But just as it pertains to the guardrails and the responsible messaging and shared value still on this topic, how does transparency and data empower collectors to make better choices? And what shared responsibilities do platforms like ours have in protecting the next generation of collectors?
Yeah, well, the collecting space is a very special hobby and a special community. And I think all of us who are in it and who spend our time doing it would love to protect it and preserve it. And so that's where the responsibility starts, is that we need to self-enforce it. And we need to apply, from our own wisdom and experience and backgrounds outside of cards, wisdom, ethical principles, you know, just general common sense, that we behave in a way that can allow us to continue to enjoy this hobby, and that it doesn't become a joke or, you know, infested with scams and bad actors. And those are things that always can happen. That, in fact, we need to be vigilant about making sure that we enforce and we protect the things that we believe in and things that we stand for, and that we keep this hobby and this community a place that's safe for people to transact and make deals, a place that that protects the vulnerable, who could possibly be taken advantage of or hurt, that we don't let that happen, and we try our best to avoid it. And that, you know, there's an upcoming generation of people who are participating in this, and it's the kids. And that those kids, you know, when they come into this space, and hopefully there's a lot of parental guidance and parental help there, but when they come into this space, that this is a place that's safe and friendly for them too, and that it's not exploitative and it's not taking advantage of them. And so, you know, that all comes back to, you know, ethical principles, being a thoughtful, careful, considerate person. And then you brought up the point just sort of about, you know, how can platforms, how can transparency, how can all these things help people? And there's two things going on here. One is that is the provision of data and information in a transparent, clean, easily accessible, easily understood way. And that's something we try to do at Card Ladder. But the other parallel too is that each of us as collectors and as members of this community, that we can lead by example, that we can show what we stand for every time we share a card, or every time we put on a podcast, or every time we're at the card shop chatting with our fellow collectors, or every time we're at a card show. that we show what we're about, that we take those opportunities to demonstrate what we stand for and what we believe in, and also what we don't stand for and what we're not going to tolerate as a community and as a group of people who, you know, want this to be a safe and fun and healthy outlet for many, many years to come.
Right. Really well said, Chris. You know, and this is something I really want our listeners to hear. It's possible to care about value without being consumed by it. And that's something I think both of our communities really emphasize. So like Chris said, he does have to bounce here in a few minutes. So we're going to skip over our final three segments here and table them for hopefully a part two of this conversation, because I think there's a lot here that we still have left to unpack. Some of the things that we were going to talk about were the state of the hobby, things like the national breaks and culture shift. I wanted to get a little bit more into the weeds as it pertains to the language of collecting, things like investment for speculation, and then just some partnerships and natural allies. So we will have that discussion offline about scheduling a part two of this, hopefully in the coming days, coming weeks. But I do want to say, Chris, this was really powerful. You know, we talked a lot about things like nostalgia, data, ethics, speculation, and, you know, most importantly, responsibility. And at Collectors MD, we often say the hobby can't thrive on adrenaline alone. It needs things like balance, accessibility, and a fair shot for everyone. And I think Card Ladder embodies those same values from a data and research perspective. So just to close us out, you know, what does responsible collecting mean to you personally right now?
Well, let me also say before I get to that I really appreciate you bringing me on and allowing me a chance to speak with and be a part of your audience and your community. And I really appreciate the effort and the intentionality and the sentiment that animates all of your work, whether it's the work that you do with Collectors MD, whether it's the Collectors Compass and the content that you produce. And just I enjoy reading your story posts that you put to Instagram. So, you know, it's very generous and kind of you to extend me the opportunity to come here.
Of course. Thank you.
Yeah, no problem. And so I'm sorry, could you remind me what's the final question here?
Yeah. So just a few closing prompts here. What does responsible collecting mean to you personally? And then the other question I had was, what's next for Card Ladder in continuing to push transparency? So you can keep it super, super brief.
Yeah. Responsible collecting is it all is measured by making sure that collecting is fun. So, you know, if collecting ever becomes stressful financially, or I'm making irresponsible decisions that are impacting my ability to plan for my future, or to, you know, have a responsible or to violate my obligations to my family and to being a responsible adult, that's a hard line. And it all kind of works together harmoniously, because if I ever do start making the hobby a stressful experience for myself, or making it too anxiety inducing, or just behaving irresponsibly, it's going to stop being fun.
Right.
So that's a very easy metric for me to keep, is that the hobby should be fun. I should be enjoying it. And it's actually such an important part of my life that I'm going to do everything I can to protect that and to make sure that it is fun and that it is responsible and that it's something that I can enjoy for a long, long time to come. And then on the Card Ladder front, you know, we try our very best. I mean, we didn't really get to dive into any, and it's very boring stuff, but we didn't get to dive in really to the methodology of how Card Ladder reviews sales and produces indexes and all that type of stuff. So, you know, but honestly, that stuff's pretty boring anyway. The big picture here is just, you know, I love working on Card Ladder. I work on it every day. Our whole team works on it every day. And, you know, that we do our absolute best to put information in front of people in a very easily accessible way, that we try to give people tools that make collecting fun and that help them do it as responsibly as possible. So then that's what we're going to continue to do.
Love it. And lastly, where can listeners find you?
Listeners can find me on YouTube. There's a Card Ladder YouTube channel where we put out a weekly show. And then there's the Chris Hoge cast, which is I fired back up. It's basically a continuation of the House of Jordans thing. I recently started that a few months ago. And then, you know, I'm on social media. I'm on Twitter, Instagram, under the name Chris Hoge.
Perfect. Thank you, Chris. And I apologize for mispronouncing Hoge. I said Hodge earlier, but it's an acronym for House of Jordan, right?
Yes, it is. I've heard it both ways. That's completely fine.
Cool. All right, guys, if you'd like to connect with Chris, you know where to find him. He just mentioned all of his socials, as well as across Card Ladder's channels. And as always, if you or someone you know is struggling with compulsive collecting or overspending, join our Collectors MD peer support group every Wednesday night at 8 p.m. Eastern, 5 p.m. Pacific. It's free, it's confidential, and it's open to anyone. You can check out our past podcast episodes of the Collector's Compass, as well as our other shows, Behind the Breaks and Collector's MD Features, streaming now on all major platforms. Thanks again for tuning in, and remember, collect with intention, not compulsion. We'll see you next time.
Thanks, man.